So I work for a statewide tribal health organization in Alaska, and we provide both, it really means we provide health care to all of rural Alaska from the standpoint of health care, community health services, public health, and also environmental health, including the design and construction of water and sanitation infrastructure. But starting about 10 years ago, we began to get a lot of reports from the tribal system leadership all around the state of some really unusual observations from the standpoint of weather, wildlife, storm events, changes to the landscape, changes to water resources. And we had to come up with some kind of a methodology to begin looking from a regional level, but also at the community level, at the type of environmental impacts that were occurring, to try to ground truth whether they were connected to climate change, and then to understand what the potential health effects could be, both from a positive health effect standpoint and negative health effects. And so that's what we're going to be, that's what we've been doing. And what I'd like to talk to you is a little bit about how we've gotten there, what are some of the indicators that we're using, and some of the mechanisms that are at work in the Arctic that are causing health effects from climate change. And I don't have anything to disclose other than a big thank you to the Indian Health Service who funded our work. So we formed this Center for Climate and Health, and the goal or our mission is to identify health effects associated with climate change and to develop strategies that will help protect community health. And we've developed five different categories of vulnerability that we're looking at, acute and chronic disease, acute disease from the standpoint, for example, of something like paralytic shellfish poisoning, which occurs related to warming water temperatures. And chronic disease, which has a lot more to do in our context with changes in diet and changes in lifestyle. Injury, I think the photo here sort of speaks for itself. Changing land conditions, especially for people who depend on being every day out on the land to collect food, very important as far as a risk driver. Food safety and security. Water safety and security, also from the standpoint of infrastructure. And probably the most important issue of all immediately is mental health. So let's do a little bit of an overview just to give you an idea of what type of climate changes are occurring up in Alaska. And I want to kind of focus here in the Northwest because this is the area we've been doing our first pilot surveys, but it's also in this part of range of Alaska which is most vulnerable to warming because it's all frozen ground. It's on permafrost. And changes in permafrost are having impacts on really all of these different vulnerability categories. But here we are, 1949 to 2009. Fortunately, we have pretty good National Weather Service data for hub communities. And so this is data from the hub communities. But this area alone, the Northwest Arctic, is the size of Illinois. There's 12 different communities there, very little information available at the local level as far as temperature, precipitation. So I'm going to emphasize that as you have to have good climate data in order to do good climate science and to understand these connections. Oops, going the wrong way. But maybe what's even more interesting than how much change is occurring is when change is occurring. And seasonality is incredibly important, not just seasons as we look at them in the Western context, spring, summer, fall, winter, but how do people in communities see their seasons, which may be 10 seasons, maybe 11 seasons, and may be driven by sea mammal harvest, and may be driven by berry picking, and may be driven by work schedule. But you can see here in the Northwest Arctic, 6.8 degrees Fahrenheit increase during winter. That's a huge change. This is a huge change, too, if you're at the point of an important climatic tipping point, either for wildlife or for human health. So just an example of how we have to lay this climate data up against other types of data to understand health impacts. This is daily July temperatures. I'm going to show you from, this is from 1991 to 2008. This is information we had to pull from regional sources. What we were trying to find out is there was a tundra lake, which was the community water source. and we were trying to understand how come they had seen such enormous blooms of algae and mosquito larvae over the course of two summers. And so we wanted to look at the changes that have occurred as far as trends in warming. And this 46 degree line is kind of the mosquito happy temperature range in that part of the state of Alaska. So what we noticed was, if you look at days of the month and you look at temperature from this period, 1991 to 2008, you had warming occurring up above this threshold for mosquitoes starting in about mid-month. And this is what happened over the past couple of years. So not only is it getting warmer sooner, but it's getting much warmer. So this is a possible indication of a tipping point, which is changing the ecology of a lake, which is then having significant consequences for the infrastructure that's used to provide drinking water for a community. So my little take-home point there is, to study climate, you need good weather data. In the rural setting, you know, you need to have these met stations, other types of weather collection, and you also need people, quite often, who are willing to collect the hard data like snow, precipitation, that kind of information, which cannot be gathered by automated systems. We found out as we were doing our work that even though most airstrips in Alaska have either a National Weather Service or an FAA weather station, only the National Weather Service archived their information. So only in the past 2 years has FAA started doing that. So all this great data that's been collected for years is basically unavailable for us to use. The other point I wanted to make is, you know, what does this mean as far as rates of change? Because this is also very important. Change is always occurring, but the rate of change is what really makes it difficult for people to adapt. In the past, we might just have spoken to this elder, this gentleman here, about the types of climate change impacts he has observed. But now, with the rate of change happening so quickly, even the youth have very important observations about the types of change they've seen in their lifetime. And that might be one of the biggest differences between what's happening in the Arctic and other parts of the world. And I was trying to put together some examples of how rate of change could be measured. And, you know, for example, with melting glaciers, if you're an observer, you might see a change in the course of decades. But with things like spruce bark beetle or the pine bark beetle you have here, people really notice those changes in years. But there are some types of changes which are happening now in the Arctic, which you really, you walk, go for a hike, you come back, the landscape has changed. And it's because of a long-term tipping point, but some sort of a climate effect that's occurred. So here's a good indicator that's being used across Alaska. This is soil temperature. Soil temperature is a good measure of how the permafrost is thawing. This is mean annual temperature at 1 meter during this time period, 1980-1989. Basically, if you have, and permafrost, by the way, means that the soil has been frozen for at least 2 years continuously. And there is some surface thaw that occurs as well. So we see different changes as far as the depth of seasonal thaw that occurs. But basically, in this model, what's white is right, is right at the freezing point. What's red is warmer than freezing, and what's blue is frozen. So here we have 1980 to 1989. Here we have 2000 to 2009. And then here's a model for future 2050 to 2059. This is a good tool to look at as far as planning infrastructure, but also to help at the community level people to begin to plan some of the types of impacts and rate of change that they might be experiencing. And here's some visual examples of what happens when you have a coastal environment that is not bedrock, but it's really just frozen soil, and that soil warms. This is up on the North Slope. This is a large erosion that has occurred. You can see that this is all permafrost frozen soil. That happened over the course of one season. And this is another image sort of showing the same kind of dynamic happening. So, you know, you're losing large amounts of land on an annual basis. Some of these have larger impacts for health. This is called a thermal slump in the Northwest Arctic. Where I'm working, there's about 1,000 of these different thermal slumps that have been mapped. This is an especially large one, and interesting from a health standpoint, because it's located on the Selawik River. Here's the Selawik River. And downstream is a community called Selawik. And you can imagine, since they get their water, drinking water from the river, what kind of turbidity issues are being measured. And we're actually seeing that by looking at turbidity measures in the water treatment plant. So this kind of erosion event has implications both for navigability of the river, people having difficulty getting upstream to hunt, for example, water quality, fish habitat, as far as whether the fish are going to be able to reproduce. And also you can see some of the changes that are happening here where you have warming allowing for shrubification and northern movement of different types of vegetation, deciduous trees coming in where used to be coniferous trees in the past. This is another example. This is a thaw tunnel that this tunnel was actually located right here in this bank. This had happened just in the course of 2 months. And what happens is when you have the ground thaw, you know, back, the river is a warming mechanism, as is air temperature. So both water temperature and air temperature are causing thawing to occur, and that destabilizes the bank and results in these collapses. And this is under one of the thaw tunnels that goes back into the bank like this, and you can see how you have the permafrost above and how it creates an avenue for water to move and soil to move out as well. But from a health standpoint, this is right next to the intake for this community's water plant. We're concerned about changes about the plants being designed, not being designed for the current conditions and the conditions changing. But we're also concerned about navigability because these large chunks of the riverbank are floating out and grounding in the river. And these are shallow rivers, so when you're traveling on it, people are really moving. And they come around a corner and you have one of these large islands that have emerged and can cause you a lot of trouble. Also, what's happening here is this is normal landscape where you have tundra. Over here, you see the encroaching shrubs. Those are willows. Those are growing very quickly, and that provides habitat for moose, which is a good thing, potentially, if you like moose. But also for things like beaver. When the larger trees come in, beaver come in, and so it's raising questions about water safety in the context of traditional water sources. So people go up the river and they're drinking the water, and we're seeing in the clinic the first cases of Giardia emerging. So this is 5 minutes. Okay, so here's the region that we're working in. I wanted to give you sort of the opportunity that we've developed working with local residents. My friend Joe here, who is a whaling captain, but he's also a great local observer, and he provided some insight into some of the changes that are occurring. Here he says, the ocean is coming and eroding the beach very fast. Some of the food sellers are gone. So this is from a coastal whaling community where they hunt for the entire community. They bring in a whale, and then that whale has very conveniently been able to be stored for 400 years in a hole in the ground because it was frozen. But now, because of warming, those food sellers are thawed in the summer and also flooding. So it's resulting in a lot of spoiling. But also here, this is a berm that was constructed by a community to try to prevent flooding from occurring. And it's great to have that kind of manpower and resources to do that. But if you don't also have help from Mother Nature in that you have freezing and a ice layer developed in the winter, the storms just blow right on through this. So I talk about some of the impacts and effects here, and then we talk about mapping as a way to show them both from storm surge, but also from the aspect of sea level rise. Here's their community, here's their escape route, here's their airport, what areas are vulnerable, and so they can begin to do some really effective emergency planning. Here's another example of a community. This is Kivalina. This community is looking at relocation right now. There is a broad range of different health implications from doing a community relocation, not the least of which is mental health, which could see some positive benefits getting out of the storm surge zone, but also could see some negative effects for people having to leave the home that they love. Here's one example of how we're using some local data to compare health effects. This is how that community gets all their water. There's no piped water and sewer. So if you live in that community, it's kind of like being at a campground. You go to a central washateria where there's a shower and there's toilets and there's also a few washing machines. But what happened is because of a delay in the ice buildup on the shoreline, a sort of typical large winter storm came in, caused extensive erosion, damaged the leach field for the water plant, and the water plant went down. And so what we're showing here is in 2004, pretty much before the storm, this is when the storm occurred here, how the number of days the Washeteria opened changed, and then in 2005, how they started to see increasing problems related to that damage that resulted from that storm event. And then trying to look at different years to see total days open by season, and you can see that 2004, then 2005 were getting decreasing days of availability of that very important resource for the community. And then we're trying to compare that with some of the ICD-9 codes that are available from the clinic to see if it's resulting in any kind of significant change as far as respiratory infection or other types of infections. So that's work that's ongoing with CDC right now. Here's just an example of some of the food management challenges. This shows an underground food storage cellar. Here's another comment from my friend Joe. He said, we used to have frozen meat and blubber in summertime, but they're not frozen anymore. This shows actually a food cellar in Barrow. It's actually 15 below zero on the surface, but because the cellars have already thawed, it's very hard to get them cold again. And so we have standing water, and it results in food spoilage. And the final example I wanted to share with you was going back to those graphs earlier where we were looking at the mosquito larva and the optimal temperature. This is the same community, and the water operator is pointing at the pre-filters. He's got three pre-filters that he uses to treat pond water before it gets chlorinated and further filtrated. And so there's the mechanism that's happening here. Is these are the kinds of ponds that are used in the Arctic for drinking water, and you can see these inundations here, these are ponds that have dried up. So when you have a warmer summer, the depth of thaw increases, and when the ice lens underneath these lakes disappears or drops, it provides an opportunity for drying. And it also provides an opportunity for warming. So that's what we were looking at, is not so much the drying, but the warming effect. And this is what happened to the water plant. In 2007, this is the number of times they had to change. They had to close down their water plant and stop, close down the water plant and clean the water filters. And this is days of the month. And so you can see this is the normal, typical, historic number of times, which is four times they would have to change their filters every 24 hours. And what happened is as warming occurred, combined with wind and a change in the lake because of more algae, they're all of a sudden spending a lot more time doing maintenance on their water plant. So for a small community, it's a big financial issue. It can also result in a water availability issue because you only have 3 months to make water for the whole year before things freeze up. And one of the adaptive measures we're doing is putting in borings with thermistors so that we can begin to profile permafrost change that's occurring in these vulnerable areas, whether it's next to some infrastructure or next to a water facility or a food cellar. So in closing, I'm not going to go through all of these findings. I'd like to just maybe focus on the last four here, and that is that public health data may need to be compared with temperature records of health infrastructure operation and other community-specific measures of climate change. Also, that changes are rapid in the Arctic, and impacts on the environment and wildlife and people are largely unknown, and only through an equally rapid process of community-scale adaptation can we prevent negative health effects from occurring and hopefully realize some positive health effects, because there are positive health effects with climate change in the Arctic as well. So thank you very much.
I know after all those talks I have some, but let's open it up to the audience first.
I have just about the social vulnerability. Are you all looking at Sure, we've actually done some attempts at modeling, and we were really, really excited because we modeled out to 2010 the variables. And I don't know how many of you did your census form, but everyone got the same form, 10 questions. So there's no way that we're going to be able to test to see if our results worked because they're not collecting that data. So the short answer is yes. Now there's the American Community Survey, which does different collections, but they have geographic population thresholds, so places, counties that have less than 20,000 people or 60,000 people, and that won't have the degree of detail. So we're trying to work those out, but our tests, we have to wait.
Over here.
Just a quick follow-up to that. So as far as you mentioned, you work with FEMA, so you know, one of the modeling systems that they have is their hazard model. Mm-hmm. So do you all work with that in any capacity?
You know, we actually have a hazardous model developer that came to get his PhD with us, and he said that the developers at the end of every year, as FEMA came to them and said, what would you like to do? And they, for years, said, incorporate social vulnerability. And then it came down to all these budgets, and social vulnerability got kind of pushed to the side. There is a new tool that's coming out that competes with HASIS that does include some social vulnerability, and may not be SOVI itself, but some sort of social vulnerability protocols or something, and I just don't know what the state of that is. But the ask has been there, it just has not happened.
Okay. I have a question for the panel. Actually, Dr. Emmerich, you made a point that being vulnerable does not necessarily mean that you are not resilient. And I know that Dr. English also commented on different characteristics of vulnerable populations and different characteristics of resiliency for populations. And so I'm wondering from anyone on the panel has ideas about possibly, I mean, throughout this conference, we've seen a lot of vulnerability maps. I'm wondering if there's any efforts to create community resiliency maps or combining the two to get at a better sense of preparedness in our communities.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, we just would comment. I think I made that comment when I did my presentation, is that I think there needs to be a little bit more thought, like, on which of these factors might be more important than others. So there may need to be some weighting of these factors or some index created of a resiliency index. I know that seems like an area for work. So what would you relate that to? That's maybe a hard question. I don't know if you would, you'd have to first come up with how do you measure the well-being of a community? Mm-hmm. And that's another whole area of research. And so you might not just want to, relate it to, how we're doing with some of the other vulnerability index, like, mortality or morbidity from heat events or something. It might be a little bit more global than that. So that would be my thoughts on that.
And a point was made at a presentation, I think, on Monday, that in terms of resilience, I concur with you that it's about the social fabric and the ability of the social fabric to be cohesive and nimble in the face of these environmental events, but in the face of an environmental baseline that is changing over time, and that communities can respond cohesively, but in face of environmental change that is ever changing. It's not about coming back to and being able to come back to a community that is as it was a year or 2 years ago, because the environment in many places already is changing in ways to which it will never return to as it was. So there's another challenge. Resilience about cohesiveness to an ever-changing future. That's really a challenge that we haven't tried to get our arms around before.
A follow-up to that, the big buzzword is resilience now, and the White House has an Office of Resilience, and they want to make people more resilient. At the Institute, we have said, okay, in order to make yourselves more resilient, we have to understand where you are now in resilience. And we actually did do a resilience index. Mm-hmm. It's called the Baseline Resilience Indicators for Communities, BRIC. And there was an article in the Journal of Homeland Security and Emergency Management. Again, we did it for the Southeast United States, but the opportunity is there. We did it at the county level. When you get down to the final level, you get much better data, but we wanted to do something that was freely available, using freely available sources. So steps are being made, but much more has to be done.
Can I ask a question on that issue?
Sorry.
And I'm sorry, I skipped off the web. When you do an index like that, you have to validate it, or you know, you're weighting factors against some kind of outcome. And I wasn't quite sure on the social vulnerability index what you were using as, you know, the outcome that you weighted it all on. And then, you know, when you do this resilience, are you weighting it on something different? Can you discuss kind of what you're weighting it on and how that gets validated and how variable that is across the different people who are doing this?
Well, I think the social vulnerability index was at one time called a metric. And with a metric, you can test it. I think we've come to realize after trying to find that outcome measure that we haven't found a suitable outcome measure. So the literature, right, the literature says these are the things that make people vulnerable, but we can't find an adequate outcome measure. And we've used FEMA data, we've used deaths, we've used all sorts of things, and we can't quite get down to the actual outcome measure. So I think we're switching gears a little bit and saying, okay, we can't really call it a metric, a Soviet metric. It's more of an algorithm for understanding these baseline conditions that may make someone more vulnerable again. But just because you're vulnerable doesn't mean you're going to be impacted. You know, it's just because you're vulnerable doesn't mean you're going to die. You know, so it's.
So there may be research in there to test various algorithms.
Yeah, we're definitely still in the process of saying, okay, we're searching for the outcome measure, And the same thing for the resilience. This is what the literature says causes people, makes people more resilient, but we need to, you know, have maybe 10 years after Katrina, we can go back and say, okay, which communities came back and to what extent, and can we model that? You know, does it match up?
At the back.
Has there been a chance to use the vulnerability mapping that can say, like, possible discharge data, so maybe picking up an occurrence of disease previously to see, like, Giardia, or these things we're talking about,
I think this is a great question, and I presented something like this at an Integrated Public Health and Emergency Management Symposium, and that's kind of why I said reach out to geographers. I would really like to work with anyone who's interested, because I cannot connect with the proper people to get the data at the level that is needed. We actually did a study for and created a medical vulnerability index for the state of Florida, but it's at the county level, and we know that the county level is great for a synopsis, but if we really want to get down to changing things, that we need to get down to locally.
Yes?
Has there work that's being done in Alaska? Is there data being collected on food safety and food security?
We're just starting to get to that. You know, one thing is starting to look at some of the changes that are happening, for example, in these really vulnerable communities where they're using traditional underground food cellars. So, I mean, we didn't even have data on which communities were using that methodology. So there's some mapping going on just to say, you know, this is 12 different communities that have that sort of traditional use. But there is some progress being made looking at things like harmful algal blooms. The state of Alaska has a pretty good surveillance system. And we're working on developing broader surveillance systems that are not just throughout Alaska, but they're also with other similar populations in other part of the countries to provide surveillance for zoonotic disease, which might result in some foodborne exposure, but also some of these common food safety issues related to marine animal consumption.
Right here.
Yeah, regarding Alaska specifically, I like your comments on this discussion about resiliency. So, you know, can measures that are appropriate to a more urbanized or suburbanized population, you know, the comparator with American Indian and Alaskan Native populations that have such high subsistence rates, are so frontier rural, and the concept of resiliency seems so different to me.
Well, you know, the Native population centers in Alaska and probably in many parts of the country have moved back and forth for hundreds of years. And it's only been until recent times when infrastructure was introduced, whether it's a school or a water plant or some kind of an economic driver, that people have become grounded. And as people have become grounded, they become more vulnerable. So I think people are very resilient, but the way we live is not, and it makes it hard to adapt. So a lot of people are asking questions about, you know, what are good models for where communities have adapted? You know, you can't just up and move every single community that's in the way of, you know, storm surge in Alaska or in the country. We've just got the resources to do it. So we focus on things like, if there's a really obvious need, a community that doesn't have a way to get out of harm's way, you know, how do you get to high ground? How do you get to someplace that's warm and safe? That kind of infrastructure needs to be developed, and that kind of emergency planning has to be done. But you know, nature's going to take its course, and the question is, do we learn from what happened in the past, or do we go back and rebuild right in the same vulnerable areas? And it seems most examples that I've seen that, you know, there's a lot of community pressure to go back to where you were before, even if it's in harm's way. And so that's where there's a great conflict occurring between the funding agencies who have the resources to help adapt communities and populations that are having trouble achieving consensus in where they want their future to be.
At the back?
Yeah, I had a question. This might be for Paul and Dr. Milton. About how is the data that's being used with the community groups, the social equity groups, so that they can push the policy, like with Prop 23? I mean, is there some interface where you're providing the data to the community groups and working with them so that they can use it for policy and influence policy?
As I understand it, the data is, I mean, the community groups in California are very much part of the coalition that banded together to fight and defeat Prop 23 that was trying to get rid of 32. And in the implementation of AB 32, the environmental justice groups are going to be part of that discussion. So all of the data from Dr. Morella Prosh is very much, I mean, those groups help build that conversation. So I think that, as I understand it, the answer is yes, they're part of what build that body of knowledge, and that they're part of the conversation that's ongoing with that. And from my conversation with her literally last night and Colleen, it's the intention that they will continue to be and need to be part of how that is implemented. I mean, I can't answer how it's gonna move forward like tomorrow and next week and next week, but I know that it's her strong belief that all of those groups have to be part of the implementation moving forward, because without the people who are exposed part of that conversation, it won't be equitable, it won't be fair, because it's about pollution today as well as about, you know, what it's going to mean for climate change in the future.
I'll also add, we just recently received funding from the CDC through Association of State and Territorial Health Officers, and we're our program at Department of Public Health in California, we're going to be working with Rachel and Manuel Pastor's group to get these digital files to adapt this cumulative hazard model they've developed. It's a very localized model, actually adapting it a bit more on climate change sensitivities. And we're going to be working in the next year to get this data together with a lot of metadata and explanatory context and put it up on the web at the California Environmental Health Tracking Program website. So I'm hoping within a year, you know, that will be, you know, available publicly online, so you can, and also like turn layers on and off and really be able to explore that data a bit better than just looking at the report right now, the Climate Gap report. So it will be a little bit different than the Climate Gap approach, but same idea.
I think I saw one more hand. Oh, there's two more hands. We're at time, but I think this is a great conversation, so I'd like to continue with.
Similar policy question, and just that I appreciate all the tools that have been introduced, and I'm especially interested in seeing a little closer the stuff specific to North Carolina. But it seems like another gap is this movement for adaptation, but then we still have this whole challenge of national climate policy in terms of mitigation. So I appreciate the work you're doing and hope that it can inform some of those policies, because we still have a long way to go in terms of bending the curve back down.
And there's one behind.
My question is, it might just be because things are still a little more on a national scale or in larger states by county, but I just find it interesting that states that have major rivers in them, say north and northeast, where lots of flooding has occurred, whether it's the 1500-year floods or because of weather in the last few years, why they don't show up on the map as being more vulnerable? That's because local level data is not available throughout the country, and the coastal areas seem relatively, or the border areas are relatively more vulnerable, et cetera, et cetera? Or is there, maybe that's less of a question. Why don't those areas show up on all these maps?
Sure.
We only did our study on the southeast United States. So, I mean, definitely every state has, and there's data available out there for every state and 100-year flood zones and things of that nature, but we're hoping to expand our study, you know, by FEMA region. So hopefully we can capture those things. The threat of sea level rise as you move further north along the at least Atlantic coast decreases because of elevation changes. But I'm not saying, I mean, the threat of hurricane, the Category 2 hurricane hitting New York would be devastating. So, you know, different threats for different places.
And just in closing, my perspective was that many of you mentioned the role of your research and your analyses in policy and advocacy, and I really appreciated the comment from the woman just now about how I think that all of your work can influence policy on mitigation and adaptation, and hope that that's the direction that we move in. And so would you all join me in a round of applause for our speakers?